This is a story of who we were, how we got here.
Houston, the Eagle has landed.
Roger, 20. Tranquility, we come.
And where we are going.
You've got mail.
So join us as we take history off the page.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of History Off the Page. I'm your host, Dr. Jason Hansen. For those of you that don't know me, I'm a professor of history at Furman University, and you're listening to our special series on the history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Now, for those of you that don't regularly follow this series, this is our sixth episode on the topic. Previously, we've discussed the birth of Zionism, the rise of Palestinian nationalism, the impact of World War I, and most recently, the Arab Revolt of 1936 to 1939. You can find more about these episodes, as well as other episodes related to modern European history, the French Revolution, communism, soon Nazi Germany. You can find more about these episodes on our website, www.historyoffthepage.com. Now, in today's episode, we're going to be talking about World War II and its impact on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or on the territory of Palestine, however you kind of want to phrase it. And for me as a historian, this is kind of a really interesting moment, comparatively speaking, because when we talk about World War II, in most countries, in most contexts, World War II is a kind of decisive moment. It's one of the most important moments, not just kind of militarily, but it has a dramatic effect on the societies that experience it. If you think about a country like Germany, the effect of World War II isn't just, oh, another lost war, but it forces Germans to kind of reevaluate and rethink their politics, their position, their sort of ideology of what it means to be German. If you think about World War II in a country like France, right, you have these long-standing debates about democracy, about monarchy. As the French historian François Ferret once remarked, the French Revolution started in 1789, and it goes on until 1989. Now, obviously, there's a lot to unpack with that quote, but the idea here is that, you know, there's this tension in French society, and World War II kind of ends up exercising, one could argue, a lot of it. I know he said 1989. I think he was trying to be kind of clever there. If we talk about Yugoslavia, right, we talk about the breakup of Yugoslavia, which is an event that we're going to go into a lot of detail about in a future podcast episode. The origins of the breakup of Yugoslavia, one could argue, really start with the experiences of World War II and the civil war that occurs in the middle of World War II. So again, World War II is so decisive in so many countries, so important. But in the Israeli-Palestinian context, World War II is actually in some ways almost like a pause, almost like a stepping back. Instead of accelerating the divisions between not only the sort of Jewish and Arab communities in Palestine, but also their relationships with the British, World War II is almost kind of like a pause, like a, hey guys, you know, we have this trouble, we have these tensions, but we need to put those aside for a moment to fight against the Germans. And so it's really kind of an interesting moment where, again, you could start to think, what if things had worked out a little bit differently? Was this an opportunity for a different direction, for perhaps reevaluating this idea that we either had to have a state in Palestine that was dominated by Arabs politically, or two states, one that featured an independent Jewish state? Maybe there was room. Maybe. Who knows? Now, there are still tensions, and we're going to talk about those. We're going to talk a lot about Haj Amin, a former mufti of Jerusalem, guy that, as we'll see, ends up working for the Axis. And we'll see this element of anti-Semitism or anti-Judaism, we'll see that introduced into the context of Palestine in the 1940s. And we talked about this a little bit already in the 1930s when we talked about the Arab Revolt. So it's not to say that the problems aren't there or that the problems aren't affected by World War II. It's just in terms of the tensions, in terms of the violence, World War II actually marks a kind of, again, a pause, if you will. So I guess to make an analogy at the beginning of the podcast, just to give you a sense of kind of how we want to perceive things here, some of you may have had friends that were living together. They were couples. Maybe they were married. And they, you know, just decided, you know, this isn't working out. We have these tensions. They kind of realize that they know where it's going and it's not going to work out well, right? So they're going to leave each other. They're going to break up. And then COVID happened. And so you have this kind of larger crisis that prevents the natural sort of separation that things were already headed in the direction of that seems kind of inevitable, but you can't quite do it because COVID, lockdown, etc. And so the two sides kind of have to live with each other for a while. And so basically this is kind of the situation in Palestine during World War II. Now, just to go over the context a little bit more, some of you probably didn't listen to the last episode on the Arab Revolt, although I would highly, highly recommend it. It's one of the most fundamentally important moments in the run-up to the Civil War, the foundation of the State of Israel, the lack of a foundation of a Palestine. So we talked about this in our last episode, right? We looked at the history of the Arab Revolt, which, again, was a massive insurgency that really represents the first real effort to solve the Israeli-Palestinian dispute through violence. Kind of another way to look at it is this is a moment when Palestinian nationalist leaders and also just the broader Palestinian community start to say, look, we have had it with the mandate. We have had it with British colonialism. We are no longer willing to kind of allow the British to manage our national destiny or our national future. Our patience has run out. Two issues in particular are of concern to the Palestinian or Arab community in Palestine at this point, and they're related to each other. Right? One is the continued Jewish immigration, which is increased and pushed and kind of made even more critical by the rise of Nazi Germany, by the attempt to drive out the 600,000 Jews living in Germany. And it's also fueled by land purchases. As we saw, the Zionists had set up a couple of agencies. They'd set up a bank. They were actively purchasing land, trying to settle the land, trying to bring in those refugees and build up the infrastructure of what would become a Jewish state. So in 1936, the Palestinians, first through a boycott, later after 1937, through an insurgency, begin to try to resist the British, begin to try to force the British out through violence. And as we saw, this initial boycott basically hurts the Palestinians far more than it hurts the British or the Jews. Palestinians, by withdrawing from the economy, open space for Jews to kind of move in, to kind of take over those economic functions, right? Jaffa, before 1936, is one of the most important port cities, if not the most important port city on the Mediterranean coast. After the boycott is over, that role will be taken over in part by Haifa, but especially Tel Aviv will begin to eclipse Jaffa as the major economic port city in the Mediterranean. We also saw how Zionist forces began working with the British military during the latter phase of the insurgency. The British, of course, pursuing British interests primarily. They say, okay, we're fighting against the Arabs here. Maybe the Jews can help us out. And then this all culminates with basically a Palestinian civil war. Forces that were more open to working with the British and working with the Jews end up fighting against forces that are less tolerant of them. Forces like those sort of led by the Mufti, who view the conflict as basically being mutually exclusive, right? So either Arabs are going to be in charge or Jews are going to be in charge. There's no room for compromise. Finally, things end with the Arab Revolt, with this kind of very interesting moment where the British decide, okay, having kind of militarily suppressed the insurgency, the real solution is political. The real sort of answer to the problem is we can't continue to facilitate all this Jewish immigration. This is causing concern, not just in Palestine itself, but more broadly in the region about the Jewish population. And so in 1939, the British release a white paper this is a new kind of interpretation of British policy. And they say, look, we are no longer doing the Balfour Declaration. We are no longer going to try to work or commit ourselves towards establishing a Jewish homeland. And we are going to institute strict controls on Jewish immigration into Palestine. The problem, of course, from the Zionist perspective is not only are you threatening this kind of long-term project of building a Jewish home, but you're doing this in the middle of these kind of attempts by Nazi Germany to drive or expel German Jews out of Germany. You're doing this at a moment when the rest of the world basically says, we don't really care about German Jews. We're still in the middle of the Great Depression. We don't want your immigrants. We don't want your refugees. We don't want your poor people that are going to come in and compete for jobs, or they're going to come in and take, you know, from our social welfare programs. So for the Yishuv, this isn't just a political question. It's a moral question. It's a question related to the survival of the Jewish people in Europe. And the reversal is understood or interpreted as a betrayal. The idea of waiting, the idea of further collaboration with the British, all of a sudden, none of it makes any sense to Zionists. And so they will begin to prepare their own anti-colonial revolution, not against Arabs, but against the British. Jews in Palestine, and even more globally, Jews that are members of the Zionist movement, begin to say, we are going to take matters into our own hands. We cannot trust the British anymore. We can't wait on the British or the international community. This is an existential crisis. This is a moment of survival. All of this is happening in 1939 as we are experiencing the run-up to war. Back in Europe proper, in 1938, Hitler had talked about revising the Versailles Treaty, had made these kind of propagandistic claims about the Sudeten Germans. These are Germans living along the German-Czechoslovak border, but in Czechoslovakia. They happen to live in a kind of mountainous region. And Hitler basically says, look, Wilsonian idealism says, hey, we're all about national self-determination. We're all about the freedom of peoples to live in the countries that they want to live. Why aren't these Germans who are, in his words, being abused, why don't they get to live with other Germans in Germany proper? And he basically threatens to start a war unless I get these people, unless we live up to the terms or the idealism of the Paris Peace Conference. Famously, there will be a meeting in Munich in November 1938. The leaders of Britain and France agree to giving this land, this part of Czechoslovakia, to Hitler. They don't bother to invite the Czechoslovaks to this meeting, by the way, awarding part of their national territory to their enemies, the Germans. But they say, oh, this is peace in our time, right? Neville Chamberlain famously flies back to Britain. He gets off the airplane. He holds up the treaty. This is peace in our time. We have averted another disaster like World War I. Hitler gave me his word. This is it. This is the final, like, territorial revision. Now we're done. 6 months later, Slovakia declares independence from Czechoslovakia, and the Nazis will basically invade the rest of, or the rump part of, what is today Czechia. They basically say, this state is too small to exist on its own. We will form a protectorate over what they call Bohemia, which is the German term for what is today Czechia. The British start to realize, okay, peace in our time isn't here. We need to start thinking about the prospect of another world war. A couple months later, Hitler starts talking about what's called the Polish Corridor. This is a part of Poland that was awarded to Poland during the Paris Peace Conference, Treaty of Versailles, basically had a large German minority, but the majority of the population was Polish-speaking. The one exception is the city of Danzig or Dansk. Danzig is made into an international free city because it did have a German majority. Hitler demands these territories. He doesn't get them. And so on September 1st, 1939, Germany will launch an invasion of Poland. Now, we'll get into the deeper history of World War II in another episode. the short version, kind of comic version of this, is that the Germans don't want to just sort of say, oh, we're just going to invade. We're just taking this territory. So they have this crazy operation where they dress a bunch of German soldiers up in Polish army uniforms. They actually kill some convicts. They dress them up in Polish army uniforms. And they stage an attack on their own radio transmitter. And so just a couple hours after this kind of fake attack, this false flag operation, 1.5 million German soldiers, supported by 2,000 tanks, 900 bombers, attack Poland from three directions. A couple weeks later, the Soviet Union will also attack Poland. And so in the course of about 6 weeks, Poland is basically dismembered. As all this is going on, of course, Britain and France will then declare war on Germany. Later on, you'll get the Japanese fighting in China. Eventually, they'll attack not just the United States with Pearl Harbor, but they'll also declare war on Britain. They'll attack British imperial possessions in places like Singapore. Right, pretty soon, the whole world is at war in one way or another. Now, when we talk about World War II, especially in the American context, especially popular context, think about World War II era movies, the tendency is to focus on Europe. The tendency is to focus on especially France, Britain, the Soviet Union. There's a lot of focus on the eastern part of Asia. But we don't really tend to think a lot about the Middle East, right? We don't really see the Middle East as being a key battlefield of World War II. But in many ways, it is a key site. Not just of fighting. There is some fighting. There are some armies moving around that we'll talk about in just a moment. But for the British Empire, remember, for about a year, Britain basically fights Nazi Germany one-on-one. Right? The French get knocked out in the summer of 1940, also very quickly, also in just a matter of weeks. The United States has not yet entered the war, at least not officially. And so the only way that the British can hang on is by relying on its empire. And of course, as we mentioned with World War I, the heart of the British Empire is India, and the way that they maintain connections with India is through the Suez Canal. So Palestine, Egypt, these two countries are basically going to be phenomenally important because you have to keep the supply routes open to India. However, when we talk about World War II, we are also talking about the first fully mechanized global conflict. Mechanization, automobiles, airplanes, that means engines, that means oil. And so the Middle East is consequential, not just because we need to keep the Suez Canal open, but more importantly, because we need access to Arab oil. Why do the British begin to pivot? After two decades of being sort of more friendly towards Zionism, why do they begin to become more anti-Zionist, more pro-Arab? A big part of it is because the Arabs have the oil. The British don't really care about what is the moral question, what is the, you know, Wilsonian ideals of national self-determination, what are Arab rights? It's basically a cruel political and economic calculus. We need oil. We have to switch sides because now we're realizing that the oil is more important and the Arabs basically have the oil. For a lot of Americans especially, as I said, we don't really think about the Middle East as being a key site of World War II battles, but it is actually, even from an American perspective, phenomenally important. If by chance you ever get a chance to go to the National World War II Museum in New Orleans, I highly, highly recommend it. Go check out especially the European theater, which doesn't start with D-Day, as kind of in many Americans' national consciousness. D-Day is when, you know, America first gets to Europe in World War II. No, before that, there is obviously the invasion of Italy. But even before that, the first real American intervention during World War II in the kind of European theater actually comes in North Africa. It comes in landings in Morocco and later on in Algeria. The U.S. Army, in many ways, that lands in Morocco and Algeria is not the U.S. Army of 1944-45. It is an army that is still learning how to fight war, how to do mechanized combat. And they do an excellent job of depicting this and discussing it in the World War II Museum in New Orleans. Now, more broadly speaking, when American historians or when even kind of, you know, you watch the History Channel, when they do discuss the Middle East, there are two things that they will kind of focus on. The first is going to be the victories of the Desert Fox, the German Panzer General Erwin Rommel. We're not going to go into a lot of detail about Rommel, but he's often kind of identified as being one of Germany's top commanders. Sometimes you'll see people debating, you know, well, had Rommel lived, had he not been injured at the very beginning of the D-Day campaign, what would have happened? One can say that Rommel's reputation is probably a little bit inflated. He does win some very important victories in North Africa in 1942. He does threaten, as we'll see in a moment, Cairo and the Suez Canal to some extent. He also manages to do this in part because some British forces had been pulled away to invade Syria, which at that time was a French protectorate, but France had sort of switched sides with the fall of France and the beginnings of the Vichy government. Again, just to give you a little backstory, 1940, in the summer of 1940, the French government falls. It's replaced by a more sort of conservative, almost kind of quasi-fascist government led by Marshal Pétain. Marshal Pétain is far less worried about Nazi Germany than he is carrying out a kind of revolution inside of France itself. And so the Vichy government essentially reaches out to the Nazis who are occupying the northern part of the country and sort of kind of makes these efforts at an alliance. Right? If you give us a peace treaty, if you allow us to keep, for example, some of our territory in North Africa, then fine, you can have Alsace-Lorraine back. We can work on an accommodation. Aren't the British the real enemy? Isn't the French left the real enemy and the sort of barrier to French renewal? At any rate, to get back to Rommel, so he wins some victories, but this is against a partially weakened British force in North Africa. There's also an element of after World War II, as West Germany needs to be rehabilitated, needs to be kind of included in NATO, you need sort of positive German figures that aren't associated with Hitler that you can kind of play up and say, well, these were the real representatives of the Wehrmacht, of the German military. And so Rommel, in part because he's dead, but also because he had been implicated to some extent in the July 20th plot, he becomes that figure. Okay, I'm starting to go down some rabbit holes, and I apologize for that. The other big moment in World War II in the Middle East that gets talked about is the Battle of El Alamein in the fall of 1942. There are actually two battles of El Alamein in the summer, late summer of 1942. This represents the first time that the Allies really stopped the Axis. They kind of blocked them, as we'll talk about in just a moment. And then in the fall, they actually reverse those losses. They attack. They break the German lines at El Alamein. And it really represents one of the first Allied victories of World War II. The first time that they are actually going on the offensive and pushing the Germans back. And this, of course, becomes pivotal because once North Africa has to be evacuated, then the Allies have the opportunity to pursue up to Sicily. Once they're in Sicily, they can move up the Italian peninsula and essentially knock Italy out of the war. Or at least they start to knock Italy out of the war. Again, not to go down a rabbit hole, the Italians basically try to switch sides. This creates a kind of coup. Mussolini gets arrested. Hitler rescues him, brings him back. So again, complications of World War II, the subject of a different podcast for another day. For our purposes, the real focus of what we want to talk about today is 1942. For most of the year, especially as we get into the spring and summer of 1942, it looks like the Axis are going to pull off a major victory. It looks like they are going to occupy at least Egypt, possibly Palestine as well. And so it begins to have some effects on the people obviously living in Palestine. All right, let's back up a second and start kind of to put a little bit more context in here. Let's go back to the fall of France, which I've kind of already talked about. But again, France falls in 1940. The government that comes to power in France, the Vichy government, is very sympathetic to the Axis. In addition to that, towards the tail end of the campaign against France, Mussolini's Italy joined the campaign, had declared war on France and Britain. And so all of a sudden, the British position in the Mediterranean is under threat. Northern Africa, with the exception of Egypt and Palestine, I know Palestine's technically in Asia, but you'd get the idea. These places become under threat from Axis forces. Mussolini had talked about the idea of turning the Mediterranean into a giant Italian lake, right? Mussolini is already in what is today Libya. And so this theater represents a key site of battle for World War II. Now, in the winter of 1940-41, Mussolini's African Corps actually smashed by the British, and this is why Hitler has to send Rommel down there with two armored divisions, some of his best soldiers. In March of 1941, Rommel begins a steady advance eastward. As I mentioned, this is also partly facilitated by the fact that the British, having defeated the Italian forces, they move some of those troops back to Syria. Syria had been basically a French protectorate, so now it's under the rulership of Vichy, and the British don't want to allow that. So then they're going to go sort of clean that out and replace it with a free French government. The biggest moment in Rommel's advance comes in June of 1942, when his panzer forces capture the port city of Tobruk near what is today the Egyptian-Libyan border. The Axis forces then continue. They come within about 100 kilometers or 60 miles of the port city of Alexandria. Alexandria, of course, one of the most important, most famous cities in Egypt, going back to the very famous lighthouse of antiquity. And so for a moment then again, in the spring and summer of 1942, it looks like Cairo will fall. The British begin burning documents. People begin evacuating to Palestine. There's this real moment again of panic going on within the British Empire. Now, as all this is going on, Arabs living in the Middle East have kind of mixed feelings about what they want to have happen. On the one hand, you have a long history of British intervention, British presence, British colonialism in the Middle East. And when we think about colonialism, obviously today that's a very bad word. We think about the exploitation. We think about the racism. We think about the psychological damage that's caused, right? Some of you may have read Frantz Fanon talking about Algeria and French colonization there. But there is also a side to colonization, whether you view it as a positive or not, that involves investment. The British don't just show up in Egypt and kind of take over. They begin investing in the Egyptian economy. They begin building railroads. They create a civil administration. Again, whether you view this as legitimate or not, I mentioned Fanon. Fanon would argue very strongly that this is not legitimate, that this is the colonization of the mind. But there are people in Egypt, people in other parts of the Middle East who are colonized, who look at this as maybe not being a positive thing, but see a benefit to having a relationship with the colonial power. The British administration in Egypt creates thousands of jobs in the civil services. They create jobs in the sense of building the railroad. There is also a sense among some, not all Egyptians, but some, British culture looks pretty powerful. British culture looks like something, hey, maybe we want to imitate that. There are in Egypt and other parts of the Middle East quite a few political leaders that think the path forward to independence lies with some sort of collaboration with Britain, lies with kind of working together with Britain. Now, I'm not trying to defend colonialism here. I'm not trying to say that it's a good thing. You can argue that there are many, many problems with it. It is exploitative. It is, in many cases, racist. Again, I'm not trying to sort of whitewash, sorry for using that term, but I'm not trying to whitewash colonialism. I'm just saying that there are people living in the Middle East who like the colonial powers and who see the future of their country, who see their national destinies as being better if they work with the colonial power than if they work against it. I mentioned racism, and there are undoubtedly elements of colonialism that are explicitly racist. This idea of a civilizing mission, right? Very, very bad. But if we're talking about racism, aren't the Nazis kind of the number one enthusiasts for racism? Aren't the Nazis the most prominent, most kind of open about their racism. And so as we have these events leading up to World War II, if you're an Egyptian and you're thinking about, okay, who do I want to, you know, sort of ally with? Who do I want my sympathies to be with? Do you really want to ally with Nazi Germany and Hitler, the people that have kind of been very open about the idea that they're superior and racially speaking, you're inferior and there's no way you can ever change that? Even if you don't like the British, in some ways they seem a better option than the Nazi Germans, right? Having said all this, of course, there are plenty of people living in the Middle East, living under the yoke of imperialism, who say, okay, clearly, you know, we had the Ottomans, they were the imperial power. We resisted them. The British seemed like, helped us, helped the Arab revolt. Okay, now the Arab revolt is over. Now these guys are exploiting us again. Now we have a different kind of colonial master. Let's work with the Germans to try to kick out the British. Right? The goal here is independence. And so you do have quite a few Iraqis, quite a few Egyptians who sympathize, not with Britain, but either sympathize with Nazi Germany or who see Nazi Germany as the kind of lesser of two evils, right? As the convenient means to an end. So when you get into the history of World War II in the Middle East, it's interesting because you have this struggle with these armies moving back between the Germans and the British. But the places where they're fighting, the people don't necessarily feel committed to one side, or they might feel sympathies towards either side, but Egypt doesn't necessarily take a strong position about the war going on Egyptian soil. When World War II begins, the Egyptians had a mutual defense treaty with the British. It provided the British with certain rights in the event that Britain became involved in a war. The Egyptian government honors those provisions. They allow British troops to move back and forth through Egypt. They break diplomatic relations with Germany. They supply the British war effort. But even though the Axis bomb their cities, especially the port of Alexandria, Egypt never declares war on Germany. In fact, the king of Egypt, a guy named Farouk I, he's writing letters to Hitler. He has a kind of secret correspondence where he kind of says, yeah, you know, I have Axis sympathies. I kind of would like to see you guys win the war. Maybe that could help us become fully independent. When the war begins, the prime minister of Egypt, a guy named Ali Mahir, is also an Axis sympathizer, but he's part of a coalition government, and that government falls in 1940 and is replaced by a more pro-British government. To make a long story short, the kind of politics of Egypt are complicated. As I said, some people want close relations with Britain. Other people are opposed to it. In February 1942, there's an incident known as the February 4th incident. Basically, Farouk is about to appoint a new prime minister. As we said, the Axis forces are making gains. They're beginning to threaten Egypt. And Farouk wants to bring back Mahir and basically put him in charge of the Egyptian government at a time when the Egyptian government is kind of under threat from the Nazis. The British can't allow this to happen. And so they will basically surround the royal palace. The British representative shows up and basically says to King Farouk, you have a choice. You can either appoint our guy as prime minister or you can abdicate, but there's no other option. So again, we're seeing this violence taking place in the Middle East, this kind of working out between pro-British and anti-British forces. We see this in other countries as well. Now, another place is Iraq. If you remember when we left off talking about Iraq, we saw Faisal become the king. We saw Iraq gain independence. Unfortunately, Faisal dies in 1933, and this throws Iraqi politics into a bit of chaos. Faisal's 21-year-old son takes over. As you can imagine, being a 21-year-old, you know, ruling a country, very difficult. And so essentially, there will be a series of military coups. You will have a civilian leadership that kind of takes over and rules in the name of the king. But the army is the real power, and you keep having coup after coup, right? So there's a lot of political instability in Iraq. Faisal Sangazi actually will die in 1939, and his three-year-old son will take over, and so you'll have a regency, and again, running into World War II, even more political instability. In this context, some people want, again, a more pro-British line. They see the path to independence by being working with the British. Other people see this as an opportunity to side with the Axis and gain what they would call true independence. The leader of the kind of pro-British forces, by the way, a guy named Nuri al-Said, he will pop up again and again in Iraqi history. But basically, by 1941, the effects of the war on the Iraqi economy, the desire of the British to place troops in Iraq, this leads to a pro-Nazi coup by a former prime minister named Rashid Ali al-Gaylani. This coup takes place on April 1st, 1941. It is backed or facilitated in some ways by our old friend Haj Amin. Haj Amin, you recall, was the Mufti of Jerusalem, was the leader of the kind of more radical side of Palestinian nationalism in the 1930s. He had been the leader of the Arab Higher Committee. He basically got kicked out of Palestine after 1939 when the Arab Revolt ends. And so he relocates to Baghdad, where he again continues this kind of pro-German correspondence, trying to kind of, again, he looks at basically Nazi Germany as the fulcrum that can liberate the Arab world from British imperialism. Another guy who also happens to be there involved in these events that we've talked about was Fawzi al-Qawuqji, who, if you'll recall, was the top military commander for the Arab side during the Arab Revolt. At any rate, to make a long story short, basically Britain will fight a short couple-month-long war against Iraq. They will chase Rashid Ali out of the country. They will chase Haj Amin out of the country. These guys will basically make their way first through Turkey, then to Italy, then all the way to Germany, where Haj Amin will work for the Nazis. And we'll talk more about Haj Amin in just a minute. So far, I've been talking about kind of events going on around Palestine. Some of you are saying, Dr. Hansen, what's going on in Palestine? That's why I'm listening to this podcast. Well, back in Palestine itself, feelings in the Arab community are similar. You have people that look at the recent experience of the Arab Revolt and say, look, our future depends on working with the Nazis. Our future should be opposition to Britain. And Haj Amin represents the kind of clearest example of this line of thought. However, you also have a lot of Palestinians that say, look, we've had relatively decent relationships with the British. The British are still clearly here. They're the ones with the power. We tried opposition. That didn't work. The British have modified their policy towards Jewish immigration. Maybe the way forward is to work with the British to fight on the Allied side. And maybe when the war is over, we will get concessions for having sacrificed for the Allied cause. Major institutions in Palestinian media, such as Radio Palestine or the Philistine newspaper, call for the defeat of Germany. They urge their listeners not to remain on the sidelines, but to actively support the British war effort. About 12,000 Palestinians fight in the British Army during World War II, and they fight in some cases alongside Jewish Palestinians. There is this kind of moment, maybe not of reconciliation, but where at least there were Jews and Arabs that were working together alongside each other, that if you could redo history, maybe you could go back and try to build something positive based on those experiences. Build the idea of a community where one side isn't going to be in the majority necessarily or exercise complete power, where their national destinies would be linked. Of course, these numbers are too small in the end to make a huge difference, but the moment was there. Now, within Palestine itself, the war is mostly experienced indirectly. As I mentioned, in the summer of 1942, especially the spring of 42, you have all these people fleeing from Cairo, especially members of the British Civilian Administration. There is some combat that takes place. In the early years of the war, especially between July 1940 and June 1941, Italy will bomb Palestine. The focus tends to be on the oil pipeline that goes through Mosul. They also hit oil refineries in Haifa. They also bomb the city of Tel Aviv. But as we mentioned, the main Axis threat to Palestine comes through the advance of Rommel in the summer of 1942. Just to kind of finish this thought about the fighting, especially this moment of crisis, the British, led by Bernard Montgomery, successfully withdraw to favorable terrain around the town of El Alamein, where they're able to halt the Axis advance in August of 1942. At this point, the war has been going on for 3 years. The Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941 has failed, even though it's made incredible territorial gains. And so a lot of the Nazi war effort is redirected from places like North Africa to the Eastern Front, where they're looking for decisive victories. The Axis advance, as I said, halts in August. Without the ability to conduct further offensive operations, Rommel decides then to kind of dig in himself, which then precipitates a British counterattack in late October 1942. Over the course of the following months, the British break the German lines at El Alamein, and they force a retreat back into Libya, and eventually this leads to the defeat of all Axis forces in North Africa. Now, before I go on and start talking about the specific experiences of Palestinians and of Zionists or Jews or Israelis during World War II, we should note the significance of this victory, which isn't just that the British finally kind of begin to break the Axis advance overall, that the British are able to push the Axis out of North Africa and kind of open up, as I said, that southern front into Sicily and then into southern Italy. But as this is going on, beginning in the winter of 1941 and especially into the spring and summer of 1942, this is the moment that the bulk of the actions that we describe as the Holocaust take place in Europe. It begins, one could argue, in the summer of 1941 with Operation Barbarossa, with the invasion of the Soviet Union by Nazi Germany and its allies. As the German forces roll through places like Ukraine, like Belarus, like the Baltic states, the Germans have reserve units called Einsatzgruppen that follow and that go basically from village to village, city to city, and shoot 1.5 million Jews. This is the first phase of the Holocaust, and it is carried out not by gas chambers, like places like Auschwitz, but by shooting. This desire to kill Jews, this desire to commit genocide, is not something that is limited in the Nazi imagination just to Europe. As the Nazis are advancing in 1942, they have a relatively small but important 24-man unit waiting in Athens for word that Rommel has defeated the British and occupied Egypt. They have an Einsatzgruppe ready and waiting to go into the Middle East to start killing Jews. Not just bombing them, not just indiscriminately, not just as a kind of casualty of war, but basically of carrying out the Holocaust in the Middle East. Going house to house, shooting them, rounding them up, committing genocide. So had Rommel been successful, it's likely that the Holocaust would have spread to the Middle East, where approximately 750,000 Jews lived. Now, I mention this not just to kind of highlight the Holocaust, but because it's important to know about the context in which debates about Jewish migration to Palestine happen, especially not just during World War II, but immediately afterwards. When Zionists are talking about the need to create a Jewish state, it is not an abstract ideal. It is not we should just have territory and land because we want to take it, because we're colonizers, because we're more advanced. It's happening in this moment where the threat to Jewish existence is very real, where the idea of the survival of the Jewish people is not just a kind of historical legend. We're not talking about Haman and things that happened 3,000 years ago. The threat of it is literally right there on their doorstep. The idea that Rommel could have killed all the Jews living in the Middle East, not Rommel personally, but the Nazis, that's very real. So again, these are not settler colonists along the Pied Noir model or the East India Company, British East India Company, coming to try to exploit the local population economically, coming to come and build mansions. These are people that view what's going on as a kind of moment of existential survival. So whether their actions were right or wrong, when you talk about someone like Ben-Gurion, when you talk about the Nakba, we can totally be critical of that. But an important part of the story is it doesn't just happen in a vacuum. It is in part created by the circumstances of World War II. Now, before we go any further, I want to develop this point a little bit deeper, because it's not just, oh, well, there's this secret commando unit waiting around in Athens. It is in the political discourse that is surging through, not necessarily the newspapers, but especially through the airwaves in Palestine in 1942. This idea of genocide is not something that is just sort of unspoken or could have happened, but nobody knew about it. It is very much on people's minds, whether they support it or not. And a really good way to see this is to talk in a little bit more detail about Haj Amin al-Husseini, again, the former Mufti of Jerusalem, the chairman of the Arab Higher Committee, the most prominent Palestinian nationalist leader in the 1920s and 1930s. Again, he's not the only one. He doesn't speak on behalf of all Palestinians, or maybe even on behalf of a majority of Palestinians. There are other alternative voices out there. But he is a significant one. Haj Amin's understanding of Zionism, of the Jewish-Arab relationship in Palestine, is one that goes beyond kind of abstract discussions about political power, about whether you should have this committee in charge, or this ratio, or what are the rights of the minority. By the time you get to the late 1930s, he has begun to view and to express his views of the conflict of one that is best understood in terms of a mutually exclusive relationship. Haj Amin does not see a future for Jews in Palestine where they're a significant minority, where they have any political power. Some historians would argue that this goes beyond, again, a kind of Palestinian nationalist opinion, an idea of, well, what we really want is just independence, and these guys are colonists, and they've come here, and we just need to drive them out. But some historians would argue that this goes into what we would call today anti-Semitism, or better put, anti-Judaism, because also Arabs are Semites. By the time of the late 1930s, Haj Amin has openly begun to argue that the conflict with Jews dates back to the time of Muhammad. Haj Amin will explicitly begin to invoke many of these stereotypes that are advanced by the Nazis about the Jews. In 1938, the Nazis actually publish a German translation of one of Haj Amin's speeches, which was most likely given in Syria in 1937. And in this speech, he says, quote, "The battle between Jews and Islam began when Muhammad fled from Mecca to Medina. In those days, the Jewish methods were exactly the same as they are today. Then, as now, slander was their weapon. They said Muhammad was a swindler. They tried to undermine his honor. They began to pose senseless and unanswerable questions to Muhammad. And then they tried to annihilate the Muslims. Just as the Jews were able to betray Muhammad, so they will betray the Muslims today. The verses of the Quran and the Hadith assert that the Jews were Islam's most bitter enemy and moreover try to destroy it. End quote. Whatever your thoughts are about the current situation in Gaza, obviously very tragic. Obviously, we're seeing enormous civilian suffering. Regardless of what your thoughts are on the legitimacy or illegitimacy of the establishment of the state of Israel, it's pretty clear that the language that I just quoted from this speech is going beyond a mere political criticism. Haj Amin by 1937-38 had begun to view the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or the Jewish-Arab conflict as one that was historical, as one that was not just a battle over resources or, you know, maybe you could have some commission, maybe you could come up with some plan where they live together. Haj Amin had begun to understand this as a kind of fundamental conflict between Jews and Arabs that couldn't be solved peacefully. Now, Haj Amin is not making these arguments in a vacuum. He's also doing it at a time when the Germans have begun to actively broadcast propaganda into the Middle East, when the Germans and the Italians, to some extent, are trying to lean on this pressure point of Jewish-Arab relations in Palestine, trying to exaggerate it, trying to make people feel more of a sense of hatred towards each other. They are telling Arabs in radio broadcasts that Jews want to annex the entire Middle East, that the Zionist project is not just about creating a homeland, but that it is about conquest, and it is about the conquest and expropriation of all of the Middle East. The Nazis tell Arabs in Arabic language broadcasts that the British had formed a 50,000-man Jewish army and that this army is going to rampage around the Middle East, taking over Arab lands. They tell Muslims listening on the radio there are Jewish forces massacring Muslims. In essence, they project the image that either genocide is happening or will soon happen to Arabs in an effort to kind of provoke Arabs into committing genocide. When we talk about how do people do these horrible things, how do they decide, oh, we're just going to go kill a bunch of civilians? One of the most powerful motivating factors is the belief that you're doing it to prevent that happening from your own side. There is a great example of this from the breakup of Yugoslavia, where one of the ethnic Serbs who had been involved in massacres of ethnic Croats, they go to him and they say, why did you do this? And he tells this story about a mulberry tree in his front yard, where during World War II, members of the Ustasha, the Croatian fascist movement, they came to his house to kill his dad. His dad wasn't there, and so they put a gash in the mulberry tree as a way of saying, we're gone right now, but we were here. We can be here again in the future. The sort of sword hangs over your life and that of your family. The Nazis are spreading these rumors because they want intercommunal violence between Jews and Arabs in Palestine in the 1940s, late 1930s. And again, Haj Amin is a part of this effort. And he's not just a nobody. He's not just some radical. He's not, you know, some guy in his basement on social media posting, you know, anti-Jewish memes. He may not speak for all Palestinians, but he does have some influence, and he does harden the anti-Semitism or anti-Judaism that then is used to argue against Zionism. Now, to play out some of this story again, we talked about Haj Amin. He gets kicked out of Palestine in 1939. He goes to Baghdad. He becomes a kind of liaison trying to help the Nazis connect with Rashid Ali and the colonels that are involved in that coup in April of 1941. Haj Amin also discusses the future of Palestine with the Nazis. again, trying to leverage this into some kind of alliance where the Nazis would go out and kind of declare the independence of Palestine, the end of the mandate. And in exchange for that, this would create a sort of second Arab revolt that then would obviously help someone like Rommel as he's approaching the British lines. This deal never really happens. One of the concerns that the Nazis have is they have coalition partners of their own. One of them is Vichy France. The Vichy French are already in Syria. They're already in Lebanon. They're a little bit worried about kind of increasing tensions with French colonial possessions. I mentioned the Italians had this dream of creating an Italian lake in the Mediterranean. Well, if you declare that the Egyptians and the Palestinians and the Syrians should all be independent, that makes Italian conquest a little bit harder. So there's kind of a game of footsie here where, again, the Nazis are using the Palestinians very clearly. They're using other Arabs quite clearly. They're playing a political game where at the first moment that it no longer is convenient for them, they're going to switch. But these efforts are out there. Once Ali's pro-Nazi government collapses in Iraq in 1941, Haj Amin once again has to flee. He goes to Tehran, he goes to Ankara, and he makes his way to Italy, where he receives an audience with Benito Mussolini. A couple weeks later, Haj Amin makes his way up to Germany. He has a meeting with Joachim von Ribbentrop, the Nazi foreign minister, the guy who negotiated the famous Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact that divides Poland and the rest of Eastern Europe and basically sets the stage for World War II. Eventually, Haj Amin receives a meeting with Hitler himself. They kind of have a little bit of a bromance, to use a modern term. Kind of talk about how much admiration they have for each other. There are debates about whether or not Hitler talks about what is happening to European Jewry and what that might mean for the Middle East. Some historians would argue that Haj Amin is aware of this, that Hitler is kind of open about the destruction of European Jewry and kind of says, look, when we get to Jerusalem, we're going to carry out the same solution to the Jewish problem that we've carried out here in Eastern Europe. Now, after World War II is over and Haj Amin is trying to kind of rehabilitate himself a little bit, he writes a memoir. He says that it was kind of maybe brought up a little bit, but that he rejected it, that he made very clear the solution to the quote-unquote Jewish problem in Palestine was simply for the Jews to leave or to have some kind of protected status as a very small minority. I wasn't in the meeting. I can't tell you how you should read it, right? You can go and look at the evidence. You can read Haj Amin's memoir. However, if you look at the language, especially from Arab language propaganda from 1942, when Germany did expect to occupy Palestine, when it did have this kind of relationship that it was developing with Haj Amin, it's pretty clear that the Germans had in their minds some kind of mass violent reckoning with Jews. It's pretty clear that their Arab collaborators had some idea that some kind of violent reckoning was coming. To give you an idea of what I'm talking about, in June 1942, Arabic language broadcasts made from Nazi Germany, often by native Arabic speakers, urged listeners to, quote, know the name of every Jew who has cooperated with the British and who has fought against the Muslims. These Jews will in due course receive their just punishment, end quote. Several days later, another broadcast added, quote, all over the country, the Jews should be watched. Every Jew's name must be written down, together with his address and business. The Jews must be watched carefully so that they may be wiped out at the earliest opportunity, end quote. Critical stereotypes of Jews are regularly featured in the broadcasts, building resentment among the local Arab population, not only in Palestine, but also in Egypt, in Syria, in other parts of the Middle East. These broadcasts describe Jews as living in luxury, as exploiting, especially the Egyptian people, They note that they want to conquer again the entire Middle East. There's a map that's dropped in 1942 that shows a Star of David flag over Jerusalem, Beirut, Amman, Damascus, Aleppo, Mosul, Baghdad, Alexandria, Cairo. Another leaflet distributed in Syria in 1942 tells readers that the new flag of, quote, the new kingdom of the Jews, unquote, will consist of Palestine, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, parts of Iraq, and Saudi Arabia. Again, quoting, who cares that millions of Arabs already live in these areas and that they inherited the land from their fathers and forefathers? The occupants of these countries will be driven out with the well-known Jewish methods, end quote. A radio broadcast from July 7th, 1942 was titled, quote, kill the Jews before they kill you, end quote. It starts by telling Arabs that the British had armed local Jews to fight against Egyptians. It then recommended that, quote, Egyptians rise as one man to kill the Jews before they have a chance of betraying the Egyptian people. It is the duty of the Egyptians to annihilate the Jews and to destroy their property. Jews aim at extending their dominion throughout Arab countries. You must kill the Jews before they open fire on you. Kill the Jews who have appropriated your wealth and who are plotting against your security. The Jews are planning to violate your women, to kill your children, and to destroy you. According to the Muslim religion, the defense of your life is a duty which can only be fulfilled by annihilating the Jews. This is your best opportunity to get rid of this dirty race. End quote. Now, again, these are radio broadcasts and leaflets. They're being prepared by the Nazis, by people who are collaborating with the Nazis. What individual Arabs are thinking as they hear this can be, and in many cases was, very different. Right? It doesn't mean that because these things were put out, this then became associated, this is the Friday call to prayer, this is the imam speech. That's not the case. But the language is out there. There are some people who become convinced by it, right? Even if it's only 1% of the population, that's still pretty significant. And if you're Jewish and you hear these broadcasts, or your Arab friend comes to you and says, man, you will not believe what we heard on the radio today, how does that not make you feel like you are in an existential crisis? If you were someone who preferred a kind of moderate Zionism, who was comfortable working out some kind of deal, maybe Jews remain a kind of minority in Palestine, but they have certain rights. Maybe there's some sort of guaranteed immigration that would be open. When you listen to radio broadcasts talking about literally killing you and your family, it makes it hard not to feel something emotionally speaking. It makes it hard to keep those bridges between religious communities or between ethnic communities open. It makes it hard for you to understand the legitimacy of Palestinian nationalist feeling and resistance to Zionism when it gets conflated with genocide. And again, it doesn't mean that everyone who hears these broadcasts is convinced of it, or the majority of it is convinced by it. Right? There are still other directions that we can go in. But with the discourse out there, it makes it much harder to convince people from one side to look at the opinion of the other side. In the end, of course, the great uprising that Haj Amin wanted, the great uprising that Hitler hoped to foment, that the Nazis hoped to foment, it never happens. As I said, in the context of Palestine itself, many Palestinians support the British, work together with Jews, and fight for the Allied cause. In Egypt, even though there's tensions, many Egyptians will also fight alongside the British, will supply the British, will work towards the British war effort. The Great Revolt there never happens either. Axis forces are driven out of North Africa and the Middle East. Axis efforts to recruit Arabs largely fail in the Middle East and North Africa. There is one context where the Nazis are able to recruit several divisions. This is in Bosnia, where you have a couple of Waffen-SS divisions that are basically Bosnian, or Bosniak, if you prefer. But again, the propaganda leaves its mark. We're broadcasting this April 2024. The war in Gaza, unfortunately, is still going on. As I said, people are still suffering. It is an immense tragedy. Why are Israelis blind to the suffering of Palestinians? Huge question, right? One of the reasons you could argue is that when they go and look at something like Hamas's original charter, the foundational charter, late 1980s, it perpetuates or invokes some of these stereotypes that are being broadcast by Arabic language speakers by the Nazis during World War II. It echoes some of these anti-Jewish arguments or frames being repeated by Haj Amin in the late 1930s, early 1940s. It is difficult for some Israelis to look at the violence of October 7th, to put that alongside the language of Hamas's original charter, of Haj Amin, and see alternative voices for the Palestinian people. To see moderate voices, to see not even political voices, to see the suffering of ordinary civilians when it comes in a framework to them that looks like the suffering of Jews. This is one of the key parts of the current crisis. How do you get people to look at the other perspective, the other side suffering, and to feel a sense of humanity about that? It's really, really, really hard to do in practice. Now, I want to switch gears here for a second and go back and talk about the Jewish population of Palestine, because the Arabs are not the only ones who have kind of mixed feelings about what's going on. On the one hand, as we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, by the end of the Arab Revolt, the British decision to issue the White Paper of 1939 to restrict Jewish immigration at the moment that it seems like the most critical for Jews escaping Europe, there's a lot of hostility to the British. There's a lot of feeling of the British have betrayed us. We can't trust them anymore. Now the time has come to take matters into our own hands. On the other hand, what are you going to do? Ally with Nazi Germany? I mean, whether or not people understood the idea of the quote-unquote Holocaust, which they probably didn't until at least 1941, 42, it's pretty obvious that the Nazis are doing awful things to Jews. And so basically, most Jews in 1939 decide, you know what, we're going to stick with the devil we know. We're going to stick with the British for now. We'll come back and hash out whatever's going to happen with the Yishuv after the war is over. Some of the most prominent leaders of Zionism, Chaim Weizmann, for example, argues very openly that Jews should support Britain. A minority, with David Ben-Gurion perhaps being the most prominent member of this camp, sort of says, well, we don't want to help the Nazis, but maybe this is a point of kind of pressure that we could use against the British. It's a point of leverage. Maybe we can secure some concessions in exchange for working with them. To make a long story short, in the end, the Yishuv, or the Jewish community of Palestine, commits itself wholeheartedly to the British war effort. They will build hundreds of new factories to meet the demands of the British war economy. In fact, you can argue that this is the decisive factor in the industrialization of Palestine. there was some industrialization that happens before 1939, not just on the Jewish side, by the way. We saw this. We saw Arab economic growth, especially during the early 1930s. But World War II industrializes Palestine in a way that it had not before, and that industrialization will occur more on the Jewish side than it does on the Arab side. Incidentally, World War II also helps industrialize Egyptian society. Now, at the same time that this is going on, you kind of have a repeat of World War I. World War I, if you go back and you listen to that episode, when the war breaks out, after realizing that the Ottomans are not going to do a whole lot for the Jewish community, for Zionism, basically, early leaders of Zionism start to try to rally forces to fight for the British. So basically, the Yishuv will undertake a recruiting campaign to get people to volunteer to fight on behalf of the British Army. Within 5 days of the beginning of this campaign, they recruit 136,000 volunteers. Now, most of these volunteers will never see service in the British Army. The British are quite aware in 1939, hey, if we create a large Jewish armed force in Palestine, that is going to create tensions with the Arab community, that is going to potentially increase separatist forces, power. It's not going to reduce tensions. And so basically, before the fall of 1940, most of these guys get redirected either not to serve, or the ones that do get to serve are put into auxiliary positions, are put into non-combat roles. So you're going to be moving the baggage along, you're going to be helping munitions get to the front, but there's not really a strong desire to have a Jewish fighting unit. So people working as truck drivers, trench builders, some work as ground crew for the RAF, even a couple get flight lessons while this is going on. As we mentioned, eventually some Palestinian Jews do end up serving in the regular British Army. You also have the Free French Forces, and you'll get Zionists that volunteer to go fight alongside the Free French Forces. Clandestinely, however, the Haganah, which you'll recall was the sort of not-so-secret Jewish defense forces in Palestine, the Haganah continued to arm itself during and immediately after the war. Under the leadership of a guy named Yitzhak Sadeh, a former decorated Imperial Russian soldier and one of the leaders of the night squads that we talked about during the Arab Revolt, Sadeh will help the Haganah organize an elite unit known as the Palmach. The Palmach was essentially training to become a partisan unit that would fight against the Germans should they occupy Egypt and Palestine. The Palmach is almost like a kind of commando unit. They're kind of like, not quite the Green Beret, but somewhere in that kind of tradition, somewhere in this idea of small groups that are going to fight asymmetrically, that are going to set ambushes, that are going to bomb key military points of logistics. This is organized as a specifically Jewish fighting unit that the British turn to basically because it's an existential moment. We feel like we're going to lose Egypt. We need all the help we can get. In the summer of 1941, the British recognize the legitimacy of the Palmach, its right to exist, and in fact, they start working with it. One of the things that these Palmach guys are really good at is scouting. Right? You've got British forces coming in from all over the empire. You've got British forces that have never been to the Middle East before, that don't speak Arabic, that don't understand it. Well, isn't it great to have kind of local collaborators? We saw this during the Arab Revolt, when the British were able to turn some Palestinian nationalists, people like Al-Hadi. How much more effective he was because he knew the landscape, he knew the terrain, he had interpersonal connections with the local population. The British will rely on Jewish forces during World War II in the same way. Incidentally, two of Sadeh's most loyal and effective lieutenants are a guy named Moshe Dayan and another guy named Yigal Alon. We will meet these names again when we get to the 1967 Six-Day War. Incidentally, those of you that are familiar or remember Israeli history from this period, Moshe Dayan has like an eye patch. He looks like a kind of Bond villain in some ways. He's known as kind of a great military commander. Moshe Dayan gets his eye patch fighting during World War II as a member of the Palmach. Now, as was the case during the Arab Revolt, the British tolerate these sort of special Jewish commando units only as long as they have to. They are aware in some ways of the hostility that these units provoke and of the kind of future danger that you're exposing yourself to. Once Rommel had been driven away at the end of 1942, the Palmach were officially disbanded. But officially disbanding something only goes so far. The Jews that serve in the Palmach, maybe they're not officially allowed to serve in it anymore, but it doesn't mean that they forget their training, doesn't mean that they forget an understanding of asymmetrical warfare, of advanced military tactics, of organization, the importance of logistics, communication. You can take away their weapons, but what happens if they get those weapons back, as they often do? In the end, the effect of World War II in some ways is going to be similar to the effect of World War I. Jews, Zionists, members of the Yishuv, however you want to call it, receive advanced military training and experience. Their military capabilities are enhanced by the war, while the Palestinian side or the Arab side, even though they fight in some cases, as we said, they don't have that same level of training and cohesiveness that you see on the Yishuv side. Not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but one of the reasons that the Zionist forces win the civil war in 1947-48 and then defeat the Arab armies in 1948 during the War of Independence is, simply put, they have a much better organizational structure, logistic structures are much stronger, command structures are much stronger. The Palestinian and Arab sides have to kind of throw things together and are kind of limited by other factors, such as rivalries against one another. So again, World War II, it doesn't just matter from an ideological perspective, from a kind of hardening of the sort of future goals of the Zionist movement. It also equips the Zionists with better military preparation for war. The final point that I want to make here is that at the same time that this sort of Jewish-British alliance is proceeding along in the 1940s, there is another tension that is undercutting them and that will provide a kind of barrier towards a future reconciliation. And this has to do with immigration. While the war makes immigration from Europe more difficult, it obviously highlights to many Zionists, not just in Israel itself or Palestine itself, but around the globe, the importance, the critical nature of unrestricted Jewish migration to Palestine. And so in 1939, even before the war begins, Jewish groups will begin to focus on fostering and encouraging illegal immigration into Palestine. And so even after the war begins, even after British colonial authorities are working together with groups like the Palmach, like the Haganah, they are still enforcing immigration rules, still kind of arresting Jews that are trying to escape to Palestine illegally. British warships are off the coast of Palestine, not just looking for German or Italian bombers or submarines or things like that. They are patrolling, especially looking for refugee vessels. They will stop them in the high seas and take their passengers to internment camps in places like the Mauritius Islands in the Indian Ocean. In a particularly harrowing incident from December of 1941, you have a ship that is kind of falling apart. It's barely seaworthy. It's known as the SS Struma. And it sails from Romania to Istanbul with the ultimate destination of Palestine. British officials, however, refuse to allow this vessel to proceed, and so it basically sits in the harbor for several months. Now, the Turkish authorities, who are neutral in the war, do not want to allow these guys to get off the ship because they say, well, if we have these immigrants here, they're not allowed to settle here in Turkey. They get off the boat. What are they going to do? They're going to settle in Turkey. We don't want that. And so the ship basically sits in the harbor for 2 months. Again, the people living on it, things get worse and worse over time. On February 24th, 1942, as the Holocaust is raging in Europe, as we are starting to see the opening of death camps that are industrially murdering millions of Jews, this refugee ship is towed by Turkish officials out of the harbor, where it quickly sinks in higher seas, killing over 700 people. The Struma incident is the most dramatic example of this kind of failure to assist or alleviate with the refugee crisis, but it is not the only example. And again, as rumors spread in 1942 of the Holocaust, British officials are still turning away Jewish refugees. So when taken together, the British position of trying to limit Jewish immigration hardens Zionist attitudes towards the future idea of independence. Major Zionist figures like Ben-Gurion, who before the war were at least still open to some concept of negotiation, of alternatives to an independent, as opposed to maybe an autonomous Jewish state, or a Jewish state within a larger Arab federation, or a binational state, these people now become militant in their demands for future independence. On the ground, members of the Yishuv increasingly see their alliance with the British as temporary, as a means to an end that will then be reversed once the war is over. After 1943, a speech by the High Commissioner, Sir Harold McMichael, indicated that, okay, we saw, as we talked about, these Jewish industrial growths, the especially heavy concentration of industry in sort of Jewish areas. And so McMichael says, look, when the war is over, we need balance. We're actually going to take apart some of these factories. We're going to move some of them maybe to the Arab sectors. Zionist commandos respond to this by breaking into British military bases to steal British arms and munitions. In the middle of World War II, as they're allied, they're going to break into the armories and steal weapons, not for use against the Germans, who by 1943 have been pushed back. The threat is over. They're stealing the weapons for what comes next. The Jewish agency no longer hides the existence of arms caches that the Jewish side or the Yishuv is keeping, but instead they openly defy the mandate government and its right to restrict or prevent or regulate their weapons. Most shockingly, perhaps, several of the more maximalist Zionist groups begin a campaign of violence or terrorism, we can use that word, in 1944, not against the Nazis, but against the British. Now, again, we're not talking about a lot of people here. We're talking about maybe about 300 people for one of the most prominent groups known as the Fighters for the Freedom of Israel, or the Lehi. The Lehi begins in 1944 an open campaign of assassinating British police officers. On November 6, 1944, the war is still going on. The Germans have just basically been pushed back to the frontiers of the Third Reich. It's not decided that they're going to lose the war yet. Members of the Lehi carry out their boldest attack ever, killing Lord Moyne, the minister resident of Egypt, and a former colonial official who happened to be kind of hostile to Zionism. Now, as I've said several times over the course of this podcast, this kind of mirror experience or parallel experience between Israelis and Palestinians in the historical narrative is very strong. And here again with the Lehi, we have another example of it. The Lehi are seen as very radical by the vast majority of the Jewish community of Palestine. The assassination of Lord Moyne, whatever the criticisms of the British mandate and immigration policies were, it is so shocking and so detrimental to the Zionist cause that the Haganah will actually begin its own campaign against the Lehi and against the Irgun. In another parallel, this, again, very small movement, very radical movement, the Lehi, they face some of the same challenges about fundraising that we talked about when we discussed the Arab Revolt, and especially some of the more radical groups during the Arab Revolt, especially Al-Qassam and his followers. How do you get money to support this cause? The Lehi will extort it from Jewish shopkeepers. They will rob banks. They will expropriate the money from Jews. At any rate, the end result of all of these actions was the formal breaking of the Jewish-British partnership in Palestine. The divorce between the two had not yet officially happened. But again, to invoke this example I gave at the beginning of the podcast, either a marriage or a long-term relationship, the two parties are living together. At some point, they come to a realization, this isn't working and we don't have a future together. And I am now living for myself. The other person is living for their self. And it's just a matter of time before one of us finally says what both of us are thinking. It's beginning to sound like a country music song. I apologize for that. But basically, the die are cast. World War I essentially just becomes a pause. And almost as soon as it's over, we're going to start seeing the return of those tensions, not just between Jews and Arabs, but especially between Jews and the British government, the British mandate. Things between Arab forces and the British will get much better, although there are also some tensions there as well. By the end of 1944, Zionist organizations, radical and moderate alike, will begin planning for a revolt of their own, a kind of Jewish version of the Arab Revolt of 1936. But we'll have to pick that story up in our next episode. That's going to be it for our show today. I'd like to thank you for listening. As always, if you like our show, please like or subscribe and tell your friends about us. As I've said before, we don't really have much of an advertising budget. This show spreads and survives in many ways by word of mouth. And so I really appreciate those of you that have done so, have told your friends about us over the course of the years. You can also check out some of our other episodes on, for example, the origins of the Ukraine War, Queen Elizabeth, the French Revolution, and much, much more. Again, you can find details about that on our website, www.historyoffthepage.com. That's it for now. Please join us next time as we take history off the page.